from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Here's what's coming up on Forum in our second hour this morning. Actor, comedian, and author Mike Birbiglia has appeared in films like Don't Think Twice and Sleepwalk With Me, which he also wrote and directed. He's also appeared on TV shows including Orange is the New Black and Girls and Public Radio's This American Life. He'll join us in the hour ahead to talk about his new solo show at the Berkeley Repertory Theater. Mike Birbiglia, after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Comedian Mike Birbiglia wrote, directed, and starred in the critically acclaimed feature film Don't Think Twice and Sleepwalk With Me, which began a story on This American Life. And now he is bringing his new one-man show to the Berkeley Repertory Theater, and the show is called The New One. It's consistent with Birbiglia's particular brand of comedy, which relies more on smart storytelling than one-liners, and he joins us in studio to talk about his show and his career in comedy and whatever else comes up, and good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks, Michael.
Actually, a lot of things began. I know you were a guy who punched tickets in Washington, D.C., but your career pretty much launched thanks to NPR and Ira Glass. And
Yeah, I think Ira sort of claims not to have been the launchpad for my career, but I throw a lot of credit his way. I had been doing stand-up, and like you said, I'd been doing tickets at the door at the Washington, D.C. Improv, and I moved to New York, and then I'd always wanted to be on This American Life, and I never could find a way to get them a story that I had written until I did the Moth storytelling series. I told the story about sleepwalking that became the basis of my movie Sleepwalk With Me, an incident where, spoiler alert, I sleepwalked through a second story window in my sleep. And Ira heard the story and then he put it on a show.
Do you still sleepwalk?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I have is called REM behavior disorder, RBD. And as a matter of fact, the authority or sort of the father of sleep medicine works not far from here, Stanford, Dr. William C. DeMet.
He's been on the show.
Yeah, brilliant guy. He actually makes a cameo in Sleepwalk With Me as himself.
Yeah, the Stanford Sleep Center really does some splendid work.
Amazing, yeah. But I'm diagnosed with that. There is no cure for that. When I go to bed at night, I sleep in a sleeping bag. For a long time, I wore mittens so I couldn't open the sleeping bag, and I take medication. Recently, to sort of double down on the sleeping bag, I have developed my own sleep sheet that fits me into my own bed and has a hole for my head.
But it's great that you can make humor out of that, isn't it? Make a living off it. Actually, let's hear a clip.
I fell asleep and I had a dream that there was a guided missile headed towards my room. And there's all these military personnel in the room with me. And I jump out of bed, and I'm like, what's the plan? And they say, it's come to our attention. The missile coordinates are set specifically on you. And I thought, that's very bad. Because, I don't have a plan for that one. So I decided to jump out the window in my dream, and as it turns out, in my life. And there are two important details. One, I was on the second floor of La Quinta Inn, and two, the window was closed. So I jumped through a window like the Hulk. And I say that because that's how I described it at the emergency room in Walla Walla, Washington. I was like, you know the Hulk, you know, he just kind of jumps through stuff.
It's distinctive, good stuff. And, of course, that missile story, we just were talking about North Korea in the last time.
Oh, my gosh,
it's a little more imminent to us.
Yes.
You know, what you do is kind of storytelling, and it struck me that I wrote a book about jokes. I mean, it's not just a joke book. It's a book about jokes, Jewish jokes. And jokes can be very serious, and yet they're not really the staple of stand-up comics anymore the way they used to be. In fact, a lot of comics have said they don't like to tell jokes, and they don't cotton to it, and they don't feel comfortable even telling jokes.
That's really interesting. I mean, there certainly are some comics like the late, great Mitch Hedberg and Dimitri Martin. There are comics still who do sort of set up punch jokes, but I think that I'm drawn to storytelling because I feel like there's a certain type of human connection with the audience. Like I started doing jokes when I was, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then when I told a story for The Moth and a few others like storytelling shows, I felt like there was a real connection with the audience where I was like, I think this is what I was meant to do.
Didn't you have a bit called Thank God for Jokes?
I do, yeah. The last show I did, which is on Netflix, is called Thank God for Jokes. And it's basically about how all jokes are offensive to someone, you know, which is to say that like jokes need targets. Someone goes down in all jokes.
That's the problem nowadays, I think, in part. I mean, John Cleese was on the show not that long ago, and he said, I can't tell jokes the way I used to, because especially on college campuses, because things are too inviolable with respect to feelings and political correctness. I know that's not necessarily anything short of a cliche, but that's what he said.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'd describe it quite that way. I feel like it so much gets chalked up to political correctness that I intentionally, and thank God for jokes, didn't use that term because I find that to be this weird like co-opted term for all different people's like needs for what they want, the point they're making. But I do think that we're at this point where the world is getting smaller and smaller, and so everyone increasingly is becoming our neighbor. You know, people in China are our neighbors. People in Russia are our neighbors. And people, I make the joke in my show, people in Texas are our neighbors, which to me is most worrisome. And but it's going to become clear that we need to be open to other people's point of view, which is what jokes are. Jokes are really just opinions. They're just a point of view. They're a feeling. And so if your approach to jokes when you hear a joke is to go, I'm offended by that, it's not very helpful for the dialogue.
Well, they do sometimes carry risk with them, let's put it that way.
Certainly, yeah.
And we're talking, if you've just joined us, with comedian, storyteller, and filmmaker Mike Birbiglia. His one-man show, The New One, is playing at the Berkeley Rep. And this is a trailer from his last show that we've just been mentioning, Thank God for Jokes. Let's hear.
I was at my urologist recently. He goes, you're a comedian? I go, you're a doctor? But I didn't say it, I just thought it. You know. And he goes, if you're a comedian, how come you're not funny now? What I wanted to say was, I'm going to take this conversation we're having and then repeat that to strangers. And then that's the joke. You're the joke later.
It's just a splendid example of how you can mine material, really.
Thanks. That's actually a good example. I'm glad you played that.
Turn it into humor. And you've turned a lot into humor, but you've also had this film career, and I mean, humor is part of it. In fact, we're talking about Sleepwalking, but also Don't Think Twice, which is really about the whole world of improv and so forth. What's fascinating to me is how you kind of did an end run. I mean, I know Nathan Lane helped you a lot, and we can talk about that. But what I mean an end run is couldn't do it with the studios, couldn't do it the normal way. Mm-hmm. So you did it freelancing and moving in your own kind of direction, your own way.
Yeah, I had this experience where when I first started out in comedy, the goal, you know, the goal that everyone told me as a stand-up comedian was, you want to have a sitcom. And that was, that's what Ray Romano did. That's what Jerry Seinfeld did. And that's the boilerplate version of success. And so as a result, I was like, that's what I want. I want a sitcom deal. And people always go, you got to get a deal. You got, you know, the agents and people in the industry. And then over the years, I came to realize that, no, what I actually wanted to do is tell stories and do stand-up and make small movies as an end in itself. And that's been extremely gratifying. Like, I feel like it's...
As you've said on a couple of occasions, you found your niche.
I found my niche, yeah. I feel like we're living in an entirely unique moment in history for creatives where you can make anything for any little amount of money. When I was in college, I spent all of this money that I had made waiting tables and busing tables, $4,000 on a short film, which was so bad that the editor that we hired stole the footage and wouldn't return it to us. And it still doesn't exist today. And that's how bad it was.
It may turn up in the Smithsonian one day.
Exactly. And that short film could be shot today on my phone in my pocket, and it would look better.
So do you enjoy making films as much as you enjoy just standing up and telling stories?
Yeah, it's a different thing. I mean, both of them are sort of perfection-based. I mean, like, the thing that I've avoided doing is making television, because I feel like television today, there's so much of it.
But you've had a career in TV, too. You've done Girls. You've done Orange is the New Black.
Yeah, I've appeared as parts in television, but I haven't created my own series, because I've always felt like, you know, if there's however many 50, 60, 70, 100 episodes of something, I don't know that endures the same way that if you make, you know, a great film, like if you make a film like Terms of Endearment or Hannah and Her Sisters, or these things where it's a 90-minute chunk that sort of exists forever and is watched and rewatched and rewatched. And
you want immortality.
I think I want immortality. Yeah, that's also that's just what I'm drawn to. I love movies and I love comedy specials and solo shows. So that's, I think you got to do what you love and not what you like.
You were in Trainwreck too, weren't you? The Amy Schumer film.
Yeah.
How'd that happen?
I played Brie Larson's husband and Amy Schumer's brother-in-law. It was Judd Apatow, who's been very generous to me. He was a fan and a friend of Sleepwalk With Me, the movie, and then we were having dinner one night in New York, and he was in town to film Trainwreck, and he said, "Hey, would you want to do a part in someone else's film, you know?" And I said, "Which, yeah, if you were doing something, I would be thrilled." And so he asked me to play that part, which ended up being very educational, because I just being around someone like Judd, you learn a lot.
Talking again with Mike Birbiglia, and what are you going to be doing at the Berkeley Rep?
There's a new show, solo show called The New One.
And breaking news, it's going to run an extra week.
Breaking news. We're breaking into this broadcast to tell you that The New One has extended into its fourth and final week, because I have to be back in New York. But so that's just sort of breaking today. The show is, I try to tell people nothing or next to nothing about the show. And the reason I do that is because for me, as a fan of movies and shows, I like to know nothing about them. Like my favorite movie this year is...
You've got to tease people to come in, though, don't you?
Well, but do you? I don't know. I'm not sure. My favorite movie this year was Get Out. And the greatest gift that I can give my friends is to call them and say, you need to see the movie Get Out, and you need to not watch a trailer and not read reviews. And that's the greatest gift I can give you. And
it's also difficult to explain that movie too. I mean, even to give a synopsis of what it is.
but I would say the same of Hamilton. I would say the same of The Big Sick. There's a lot of things. I just say, just go. It's unique. And that's what I'll say about the new one. It's like, if you like Sleepwalk With Me or Don't Think Twice or My Girlfriend's Boyfriend, Think Out of Her Jokes, you'll like it. If you don't like those, you probably won't like it. So those are on Netflix. It's basically free. You can borrow someone's password. And if you like those, then great. And if not, then it won't work out.
You got a reputation too, Mike. I mean, you know, people want to see you and they enjoy you. And that has a lot to do with it. And you really enjoy making people laugh, don't you?
I do. I like sort of the live theater element of Anything Can Happen.
And Nathan Lane, we mentioned before, I mean, a major figure in terms of launching you and helping you in your career, just out of what I think you've described as sheer generosity.
Right? The sheer generosity. I mean, he saw me at Caroline's. He had heard one of my albums. This is over 10 years ago. He had heard one of my albums, come to see me at Caroline's, and then sent me a really generous handwritten note. And said, I really enjoy what you're doing. Keep going. And that was the material was from Sleepwalk With Me. And so we went out to dinner one night and I said, I'm trying to mount this as an off-Broadway show. And he said, well, if you ever do it, then let me know. Cause I'd lend my name to it. You know, like Nathan Lane presents, you know, Mike Birbiglia and Sleepwalk With Me. And I did. I mean, there was no contract. He didn't make any money. It was just this sort of friendly, generous gesture on his part that in a lot of ways, I mean, honestly, if he didn't do that and Ira Glass didn't put me on This American Life, I really don't know that I'd have a career in the way that I do.
Shows a lot about luck and careers.
I think so.
But I remember reading a piece you did in the New York Times where you said, if you want to have a successful career, failure is essential.
Oh, I think so. Yeah. Well, in stand-up, stand-up and theater, I think, is particularly essential. It's like you just have to put out things that don't work to understand what could work.
You also said in that article you need harsh feedback even because it can be helpful as much as it may hurt.
Yeah, I think and Ira certainly is a constant source of harsh feedback. He's given a lot of tremendous notes on this show, the new one. He came to see it in Philadelphia and New York and a bunch of different places, and has given tremendous feedback to the point where I remember we had dinner recently, and he goes, I don't even know if I should be telling you this stuff. It seems like it's just making you feel bad. And I go, no, please keep telling me. And I'm writing it all down. Yeah, I mean, harsh feedback is what you need.
And also sometimes weird feedback or random feedback, you say, can be helpful. Yeah,
I think so. I mean, one of the things I will say to people in the Bay Area about this show is all ages, in the sense that I have stared at people in the audience who are maybe 80 or 85 years old who are loving the show, and I've stared at people who are 20 years old who are loving the show. And it's and connecting it. Connecting to it for entirely different reasons.
It's always a challenge, though, keeping that audience, especially when you have that range of demographic. Yeah.
Yeah. The only thing I would say is I wouldn't bring like a 13-year-old or a 14-year-old kid to the show. That sometimes happens. You'll do a show and there'll be like a 9-year-old child in the audience, and you'll just go, this is really inhibiting, because everybody in the room is thinking, like, that kid shouldn't hear this. And which is, by the way, not to say there's nothing in my show that language-wise is gratuitous, but the stories themselves are just human stories and inherently have some adult themes.
We're talking with comedian, storyteller, filmmaker Mike Birbiglia. His one-man show, the new one, is playing at the Berkeley Repertory Theater. And I said before we went on the air that it's interesting that Tony Taccone and the Berkeley Rep working with one-man shows now. We had John Leguizamo on. They're looking for people with difficult names, obviously.
That's what it is,
one-man performers and everything. By the way, your name, like Camille Paglia, doesn't pronounce the G in her name. She just says Camille Paglia.
I know. I mean, that's my parents' fault. I mean, you can't blame me for that. They started calling me Mike Birbiglia, and you know, people come up to me, they'll say in Italy it's pronounced Birbiglia, and I say in America you're annoying because people insist on pronouncing it the way they want to.
Yeah, you like to talk about things that annoy you, maybe even that disgust you. You talk about late people, for example.
Yeah. There's this whole section in Thank God for Jokes where I talk about late. I really think there's a distinction between late people and on-time people. And what late people don't understand about us on-time people is that we secretly hate them. And the reason that we hate them is it's so easy to be on time. You just have to be early, and early lasts for hours, and on time lasts a second. And then you're late. And so, I actually, in Thank God for Jokes, if people see it, you'll see that there's this thing I developed, which is that if people come in late for the show, and these are real people, by the way, sometimes people say, did you plant those people who are late? They're like, no, there are always late people. They're always – at every single show I did.
It's like it's in their DNA or something, isn't it?
Yeah. I did that show in 112 cities in America, which is more cities than there are. And they're always late people. But I would call them out. And it came – the bit came out of doing so many shows where people were late, where I was like, I think I need to build a whole bit about late people to take these people down a notch.
And you succeeded.
Yeah.
Think about that New York Times piece again where you write about how much more important the heart is than cleverness.
Yeah. And if people want to read that, it's I think it's how to make it – I think you look up – how to make it small in Hollywood. that's how I describe what I do. I make small things in Hollywood. And part of that's from Ira and me and Ira talking about cleverness versus heart. And I think that cleverness is, I mean, there's a lot of cleverness out there. There's a lot. I mean, we're a very heavily educated society. People...
A lot more cleverness than heart.
Yeah. And heart is more risky. Heart is this thing where there's very few people who are willing to walk on stage and open up.
You've done it though.
I try to.
You push yourself to do it. Yeah.
I try to like anyone else. I mean, sometimes I fail, sometimes I succeed. I'd like to think with the new show I succeed.
Well, we're coming up on a break. I want to give listeners an opportunity to talk to you about your work and to talk directly with you. And any questions or comments you might have, you can indeed join us. I invite you to do that now. Mike Birbiglia is going to be a Berkeley rep, and he's got a new show out called The New One. If you'd like to talk with him, if you'd like to join our conversation, please do. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us now at that number, 866-733-6786. And there are a number of other ways that you can bring your questions or comments to us. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We'll continue with our guest here in studio, Mike Birbiglia. Feel free to join the program. I'm going to get him to tell the David O. Russell story. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Mike Birbiglia, who's here with us in studio, and we do want to have you join our conversation and be a part of the program. You can do that a number of ways, as I said before the break. You can call us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. And I've been talking about a number of things with Mike, including his New York Times article, which is called 6 Tips for Making It Small in Hollywood or Anywhere. It's now on our website, kqed.org. And again, we do welcome you to be part of this program. Let's hear some more of his work. This is from his second Broadway show, My Girlfriend's Boyfriend, about his first girlfriend.
I find that when you fall in love, you tend to overlook certain red flags. One of them was that she would say really mean stuff to me, but then she would pull it back. She'd be like, no one likes you at all. Only kidding. Or like, you're like a nerd, but you're not even smart.
Just joking.
Can't choose who you love. Second red flag with Amanda was that she was a liar. And I don't mean that in an offensive way. Like, lying was kind of like it's like a sport at the school I was at. I transferred from the all-boys school to this co-ed school. There was this one guy in my class named Keith Robbins who was a legendary liar. You'd know when he was lying because he would lick his finger like a bookie, and he would dart his eyes from side to side. And he'd go, yeah, yeah, nice, nice, you know? And he wasn't even handling money. Like, I don't even know what this is about. And then he would lie about things that were sort of insignificant. He'd be like, yeah, my uncle's Tony Robbins, motivational speaker. Yeah, nice, you know? And we found out that that wasn't even true. But even if that were true, that wouldn't be impressive to a bunch of high school students. But I think that's the Jedi level of lying, is you lie about little stuff and no one notices when you're lying about big stuff. It's like banking.
A good line at the end there, especially. You brought it up. Good timing. Funny story. And that girlfriend of yours that you write about, she was the one in Sleepwalk, broke up with her, and there was some pushback on that or some problems?
Different ex-girlfriend. The one that story you were playing just now was from high school, and I was actually just cringing, thinking that somewhere in the universe she's hearing that and going, that's not my side of the story.
And somewhere Tony Robbins' nephew is.
Yeah, that's disguised by name. And then my ex-girlfriend from Sleepwalk With Me, the character's name is Abby. This is a unique sort of life thing that occurred. She and I had a very amicable parting, and she married someone else, and I married someone else. And then she lives in the Bay Area. She was one of the main roles in Don't Think Twice. She plays my girlfriend in Don't Think Twice, which was, I've never said this in an interview, her name is Maggie Kemper. She's a great actress. It was my wife's idea. Mm. My wife said, we were trying to cast this part of my character, Miles' girlfriend, and my wife said, who was a producer on the film, she said, I think you're trying to cast, we were looking at tapes of all these people, she goes, I think you're trying to cast someone like Maggie. Why don't you just ask Maggie if she'll do it? And I did, and she said yes, and I think she's wonderful in the film.
And your wife's name is Jen, but you call her what?
Chloe.
Why is that?
It's honestly, it has no, I always say in my shows, I said to my wife, I said, Chloe, her name's Jen. and it's really based on almost nothing. At a certain point, she started calling me Mo, and I started calling, which I think is a short of Mike, started calling me Mo, and then I called her Mo. And then she goes, no, my name's not Mo. And I said, what's your name? She said, it's Chloe. And then it stuck.
So she named herself.
She named herself.
Let's bring some callers in here. Let me go first to Palo Alto. John, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say I am a big fan of Mike Birbiglia.
Thanks.
Don't know why I'm talking about you in the third person.
I'm right here.
I'm a big fan. I'm kind of... And I would like to know, what advice do you have for someone starting in stand-up comedy, or is it just a terrible idea to start?
And how old are you, John?
14.
14. An aspiring comic at 14. Give him some wisdom, Mike.
Well, the good news is 14 is a good age to start because there's a long history of comedians like Dave Chappelle and Eddie Murphy and others who Judd Apatow, who started when they were kids, and so that's a good age to start. Good age to start anything, frankly, because it's a long, long road. And that's actually would be the second half of my advice, which would be I'm stealing from a comedian named Eugene Merman, who once said to me that when people ask him for comedic advice, he says, "Start doing it, keep doing it." call me in 10 years, which I think is great advice, which is, which is to say, it just takes a long time and an extraordinary amount of writing and free writing. Like I always say, like to develop an hour of stand-up comedy, I really have to write about 5 or 6 hours of stand-up comedy, and then about 4 hours ends up on the cutting
room floor. And your films, I was reading, you go through like double-digit drafts on those.
Yeah, yeah. So with each film I've written, I've done about 12 or 13 drafts.
I'm going to bring another. Thank you for the call, John. I'm bringing another caller on here, and that's JC. JC, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I want to say I love Mike Birbiglia's comedy. I've been a longtime comedy junkie, and one of my questions has always been how much the comedians feel their comedy comes across because it's them telling the joke, like in the way that his voice sounds and his physical appearance, or is the comedy really inherent? Like, could somebody else take his bits and do them and have people find them funny, even if they didn't know Mike had come up with them originally?
I think that I was given this piece of advice by a guy named Lucian Hold, who booked the comic strip on Comedy Club on the Upper East Side through the 70s and 80s and 90s. He passed Jerry Seinfeld, and he passed all kinds of Eddie Murphy and Chris Rock and all these great comics over the years. And he said to me a piece of advice once that I thought really hit home, which is, he said, if you write about yourself, no one can steal that. Because there is a lot of comedic theft and things, but I think that
I think he's wrong, by the way. People steal from anything.
Even. Oh, that, yeah, sure.
But
sure.
He means probably, I hope he means, your own authenticity, your own style,
yeah,
your own voice.
I
all
think
that,
so, you know? Yeah. I mean, I write autobiographical stuff, and I hope that's answering your question. I think that, sure, there's lines and things you could pull out and repeat to someone else, but a lot of, you know, I think the best comedy is you really have to be there. You really have to be in the room to witness it.
Thanks for the call, JC. Tried stand-up comedy once at a place called the Holy City Zoo.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I wanted to write about what it was like to stand-up.
The legendary Holy City Zoo, yeah.
And I realized, I mean, the night dragged on and I got up there. People were more drunk and all that sort of thing, you know, dealing with that. But you really have to win an audience if you're a stand-up comic. You have to get them on your side fairly early on and
Brian
make sure
Regan
they're with you.
Brian Regan's this great comedian, and he has this line about audiences, which I think is really smart, which is you have to take a group of strangers and turn them into an audience. And if you don't, then you'll bomb.
Well, then there were people like Larry David, you know, who everybody thought was the comedian's comedian, and somebody would sneeze or say something negative and he'd just walk off the stage, you know.
Yeah.
So he had to do things like Curb Your Enthusiasm to get his humor across.
Yeah.
Let me read some comments. Karen writes, you bring so, how many O's are there in so here? About 6 or 7. So much joy to my life. I hope your show, I hope your show doesn't sell out. Well, the first thing is nice, but you would like your show to sell out.
Yeah.
And Nora writes, from listening to you on This American Life, you have a very effective method of sharing an entertaining story, which transitions into a subtle yet powerful conclusion. Your telling of it is so much more than the sum of its parts. Are there writers or performers who were inspirations for your particular style of storytelling?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, like with This American Life, I remember I would listen to David Sedaris's pieces, and those were very influential, that you could have a story with a narrative arc, but that would have a series of jokes embedded within it. So I was really impressed by that, and then his books. And then in terms of pure stand-up, I feel like those early Cosby specials were really influential. And, of course, it's hard to distinguish between Cosby's personal and professional life at this point. But really, that first, like, Bill Cosby himself special, or one of those first specials, was so powerful. Just the calmness that he has when he delivers. And then Richard Pryor is probably, to this day, the biggest influence. And I would say most comics would say he's the greatest influence on stand-up comedy in general. Live from the Sunset Strip is this special he has, which I think is on Netflix. It's definitely out there in the digital world. My director, Seth Barish, and I spent a lot of time studying that Sunset Strip performance because he takes this thing, which is he freebased with cocaine, and then he lit himself on fire by accident, and he's running down the street, and then he has to go, and he's dealing with the burns at the hospital, and they're pulling off the bandages. Very, very painful story, truly painful. And he makes it hilarious, and but he doesn't sell short the drama of what's happening. And we tried to mimic that with Sleepwalk With Me, this idea that jumping through a second story window sleepwalking can be funny.
Okay, we're talking to Mike Birbiglia, and his new show, One Man Show, is the new one. It's at the Berklee Repertory Theater. And let's hear another clip. This is of you talking. I happen to see this with Stephen Colbert. Easy to talk to and fun?
He seems, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, you enjoyed it?
He's very sweet. I really admire him. He's a real luminary of comedy. What he's done in comedy is, I think, one of the great all-time, you know, that persona he created is legendary.
He's also, thanks to Trump, now way ahead in the ratings. It's done very well for him. But let's hear this. This is you talking with him about parasitic mice. Wait a minute. We're trying to get this up here.
Sure.
Trying to get it on. You want to give us a little background of that?
This is from Thank God For – is a story in Thank God For Jokes where I talk about the idea of that the best jokes are inside jokes and that are often not funny when you – like I'm saying, when you explain them to people. But when you share them with your wife or husband or partner, that they're hilarious.
Let's hear.
So they have a parasite in them, and they want it to be in you.
The mice don't.
They do.
The mice do not.
I swear to God.
Mice don't know.
You need to research this, Stephen.
Yes.
So they're unafraid of cats, and they're unafraid of people.
Wait, they're unafraid?
I swear. My wife was watching TV on the couch, and she looked next to her, and there was a mouse, and he was watching TV also. And she screamed, and he just looked up at her like Stuart Little, like, hey, what's going on? I don't like this show either. I don't know why all those women would want to marry that one guy. And she pushed him off the couch.
Uh-huh.
And
just pushed
he didn't,
him off? Just pushed him off? It's a
just
very
like,
calm response.
You know, just kind of swatted him off.
Okay.
And he didn't even run away. He didn't even scurry, which is a verb invented for mice. He just walked through the kitchen like a roommate. He was like, fine, I'll go in the other room. I just think you're overreacting. Then he did a confessional into the mouse cam in the kitchen. He was like, I'm not here to make friends. I'm here to win. I was here before they came. I'll be here when they're gone. I'm a mouse. That's from Real Mousewives of Cassachusetts.
And Cassachusetts has become kind of an iconic use of language for people up there.
Cassachusetts and Massachusetts
are the inside jokes that my wife and I permanently use from that story.
Those are the inside jokes. Well, and your names for each other, too, for that matter.
Yeah, Mo and Claw.
Matt tweets, Mike, love your work, but my wife doesn't think you're funny. Pretty sure it's because she's a late person. See you in Berklee.
Oh, yeah.
And Patrice says, Mike Birbiglia, are you the voice of Martin on Downward Dog? If so, bravo. If not, why not?
I get that all the time. People tweet that at me constantly. There's a show called Downward Dog, apparently, and I am not that voice.
I guess the voice sounds pretty similar, though, if people are constantly tweeting you about it. Huh?
I guess so. I think there's a lawsuit in the works. There's got to be something in that for me, right?
Well, we'll wait and see. But is David O. Russell going to litigate? I asked you to tell that story.
So I don't know if there's a version of the story that's made for public radio, but I'll try and we'll see how it goes. This is a story from Thank God for Jokes where I was asked to host the Gotham Independent Film Awards a few years ago when Sleepwalk With Me came out, and I did. And you make jokes, you try to write jokes about people who are in the audience and people who are there and the movies that are nominated. David O. Russell was there, one of the great directors. He's a Silver Linings Playbook, you know, Spanking the Monkey, I Heart Huckabees. He's directed so many of The Fighter, so many of my favorite films. infamously, he shouted at Lily Tomlin on the set of I Heart Huckabees, and it was on tape, and it was put on YouTube, and it was seen by millions of people, and he basically screams, and I won't say what he said. I couldn't possibly say it in public radio. He screams at her in this expletive-filled rant, and so I thought that would be funny if I said I made a joke about that on stage and he's in the audience and I say, David O. Russell's here, one of my favorite directors, known for going to extremes to get exactly what he wants. The great director Ilya Kazan once said, you do whatever it takes to get the shot. And David O. Russell once said, I'm just trying to help you, expletive, expletive, expletive. And then I, at the end of it, I said, two great directors basically saying the same thing.
Yeah. This is a great line.
And so he,
but Russell was not happy about it.
No. Everyone in the audience laughed. David O. Russell left the room, threatened to leave the event. He was so offended by this. And so anyway, it became sort of the one of the main points in my – or stories in my Thank God for Jokes show, which I ran off Broadway for like 4 months. And I always held out hope that one day David Russell would show up in the audience, and he did not.
But you can always push that envelope sometimes. I was thinking suddenly almost by association of Gilbert Gottfried after 9/11.
You know,
famous story. Came out and told a joke. It was not the timing for it. And, I mean, it took Letterman a long time before he even would do any irony around that.
Yes.
You said something once, I think, didn't you, about doing some researching for Al-Qaeda or recruiting for Al-Qaeda. I'm sorry. Yeah. Do you know? Remember the line?
Are you thinking of the lesbian terrorist joke?
Gosh. Again, you're kind of pushing the envelope.
I forget the exact joke, and I feel like I'll botch it. But yeah,
maybe
had a joke about that.
You want to forget it at this point?
Really? No. I like that joke. Oh. It's just that I have like 6 shows in my head from over the years. So I don't have them all.
You're
at my disposal.
Talking about the Birbiglia canon at this point. Let's let's get another caller on, and that's Chad. Chad, welcome.
Thanks. Mike, I'm a big fan.
Thanks, Jen.
Like you, I went to Catholic high school, and I am, in fact, a high school teacher, and for years I have taught error at first base to my students.
Oh.
So you mentioned David Sedaris earlier.
Sure.
I'm curious if you can talk for a little bit. How do I say this delicately? I have a friend who says all stories are true, and some of them actually happened. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what's the relationship in your work between the truth and the story.
I love that line. All stories are true and some of them actually happened. That's such a great line. Someone asked Sedaris once, I think in an interview, are your stories true? And he said, true enough for you.
You know what it reminds me of? Do you know a novel by Ken Kesey called One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Oh, yeah, sure.
It opens with Chief Brobnum saying, it's the truth even if it never happened.
Yes.
And you do that when you essentially bring these narratives on board. There's truth to them even if you're expanding on what really happened or fictionalizing even.
Yeah, I mean, I think that my director and I always talk about the emotional truth of stories. So what you want to ultimately do is express something that you truly do feel and combined with something you experienced. The problem is what you experienced, it's kind of like the raw footage of a documentary is not interesting. I've seen cuts of documentaries before in the early rough cut stages, and they're boring because there's just so much fat and there's so much – and, you know – And so you ultimately have to edit it into something that is worth listening to and worth people's time. And so that's what I would say. I would say if you ballpark the percentage, I would say like 80 to 85% of what I say on stage is true, and then 15% is sort of convenient so that people don't leave the theater.
Well, you have to keep them there. Right?
Yeah. And then, it's my job to entertain them, not to give them a play-by-play of my existence.
Let me thank Chad for the call. I'm reminded of famous American novelist, Philip Roth, you know, who once sat down and tried to write things as they actually happened. As
was that right?
To, yeah, I mean, because obviously he used a lot of autobiographical experience, but he allowed his imagination to run free. And then he sat down and wrote a book called The Facts, where he was just trying to be essentially repertorial or journalistic. Didn't keep the interest, not only of a possibly interest to the audience, but didn't keep his interest enough.
The seed of this show, actually, more so than any of my other shows, was my wife and I went on vacation last September for 2 weeks. This is the longest we've ever gone on vacation in all of our 14 years of knowing each other. And every morning I would get up and I would write from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. and I would entirely free write however I was feeling, and I would spin that into wherever it would go, and I would free associate. And at the end of 2 weeks, I had like about a 30,000 word document. And I basically whittled that down into what is now about a 10,000 word show.
So as a man who did a lot of work in improv, made a whole movie about improv, you're not doing that much improvisation, really.
No. No, they're very
You've got a whole script in your head.
Even Don't Think Twice, which is about improv, the movie Don't Think Twice, it's a very written movie. I mean, it was 12 or 13 drafts of the script.
And so the script is in your head when you're in the Berkeley Rep. Can you deviate from it if you see
a
possibility?
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly, someone's cell phone went off the other night 3 times, and I felt it's the same guy. His cell phone went off 3 times, and I felt like you have to acknowledge this is live theater. You have to acknowledge that.
It's so annoying.
I don't take this, listeners, as an invitation of that's what I should do. The Berkeley Repertory Theater, I've actually been going for years to see shows there because my sister Patty lives in Oakland, and so I've always been a fan of their shows. It's a beautiful theater. They have 2 theaters. They have the 800-seat theater and the 400-seat theater,
right.
And I'm in the 400-seat theater, which is gorgeous. It's and every seat is great, and it's intimate to the point where the other night someone sneezed, and I said, "God bless you," and then we spent a few minutes talking about the nature of the sneeze and what it sounded like. And then I returned to the show. But that's what's lovely, I think, about theater is that it's happening. It's
another thing you say, you talked about why you say God bless you when somebody sneezes, which is a kind of fascinating little footnote on life sometimes. Why did you get involved in Girls? Was that Judd Apatow too? Or
it was,
he produced it.
Lena.
You knew Lena Dunham?
Yeah. So I had met Lena after her film Tiny Furniture premiered at South by Southwest. And I loved that movie. Just loved it. If people haven't seen it, you should check that out. And we had lunch and we really hit it off and we've been really close friends ever since. And she just asked me. I was sort of like, she and I would have lunch after Tiny Furniture, and she'd say things like, "So, cool thing this week, Judd Apatow just called me and said he wants to make a TV series." And I was like, "Oh, that seems really exciting." This person called, "Oh, okay, that's great." And then next thing you know, she has this sort of zeitgeist, series, which is phenomenal. And I had a blast doing that episode.
You know, when you said you had lunch, and then before you were talking about having dinner with Nathan Lane and so forth, you could do a whole shtick on who you have dinner with as opposed to who you have lunch with.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. I never thought about that.
So you do like TV work, though. I mean, Orange is the New Black, enjoyed as well?
It's been really nice. I'm actually, most of my scenes, I play this character, Danny Pearson, who's sort of a corporate shill in the prison corporate industrial complex, and I have a blast being around there because those episodes are directed by these phenomenal directors. Like, one of the episodes is directed by Nicole Holofcener, who's one of my favorite film directors, and it's these great actors. I work mostly with this guy named Nick Sandow who plays Caputo, and I have a blast over there.
Question from a listener. Do you get bored doing the same show every night?
It's a good question. I think when I, I'll take the show somewhere off Broadway in 2018, and sometimes that will happen. Like if I run a show for 4 months or 6 months with Sleepwalk With Me, I did 8 months. Yeah, it does reach a point where you have to sort of find the interesting part of it. within the show.
A lot of actors say it's different every night with a different audience. So.
Yeah, but I will say, yeah, that's true. And then also, these 4 weeks at Berkeley Rep in some ways are the most fertile, because the show is – I'm trying new things every night in the show. So I'll spend like a few hours working with my director every day.
Tony Taccone is your director?
No. Seth Barish is the
director.
It's
Seth Barish,
and
our,
Tony Taccone is the artistic director of the theater, and he's given tremendous notes too. But yeah, I'll meet with Tony or I'll meet with Seth Barish and get feedback. And so actually these shows are very charged in a lot of things I'm saying for the first time.
Are they as tough on you as Ira Glass?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, sure.
That's what you want.
I mean, Ira's the toughest though. Ira's just like... I remember with Don't Think Twice, I would have these little readings at our apartment and my wife's in my apartment and invite actors over to read the parts. And I remember after like the second reading, Ira just goes, "It's just not a movie." I go, "That's a really hard note to work with." It's just not a movie.
Should mention the apartment is in Brooklyn. You're there,
yes,
with all those young zeitgeist people, right?
I guess so.
Yeah. You've had already a very diverse and fascinating career. Good luck and ongoing success. And
thank you so much.
Again, you can see Mike at the Berkeley Rep. He's appearing in the new one. It's going to be running for 4 more weeks. Appreciate your being with us.
This is such an honor. Thank you very much.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.